basic mathematical tools. We did Green's functions and the Fourier transform, and these are very useful for many applications. And basically, today I'm going to cover one of the applications, which will be classical electrodynamics. And tomorrow I will do some applications to quantum field theory and gauge theories. Okay, so today's lecture is classical electrodynamics. And I'm hoping that this will be a review for most of you, because everybody, I guess, had to pass a certain level electromagnetism course, and so on. So I'll start from the Maxwell equations. So one of the most beautiful equations in theoretical physics. So Maxwell equations. And I'll write them in the following form. So minus, so it's curl of B. So this is Nabla operator, this is the vector product, and together it forms a so-called curl. dE over dt equals to 4. I'm using the Gaussian units, so that's different from SI units. So it has 4 pi on the right-hand side, 4 pi j, and I'm too big, doesn't matter. Curl of E plus dB over dt equals to 0. Divergence, again, the Nabla operator, scalar product, divergence of E equals to 4 pi rho, and divergence of B equals to 0. So let me just name them. This is my first equation. This is my second equation, third equation, and the fourth equation. Who hasn't seen that? Everybody's seen. Perfect. Okay. So that's the whole electromagnetic theory. That's the theory of light, the theory of optics, theory of everything, except gravity, except quantum effects. Very good. So now we want to, so if you look at these equations, you want to count unknowns and, well, hence the degrees of freedom, and you want to know how many equations you have and so on. So what are the unknowns here? So counting unknowns. So what are the unknowns here? E and B, exactly. So it's the electric intensity E, which is a vector. So it's three components. It has three components. And the magnetic induction B, which has three components. Right? So how many equations do I have? So how many equations is this thing? So it's a vector equation. So each of these quantities here is a vector. J is the source. It is the vector. So there's three equations here. Three equations there, one equation here, one equation here. So I have six of these, but I have 8 equations. So how is that possible? Any suggestions? Sorry?
Equation of motion.
And they are? And what they are? Close. Very good. So there's something suspicious about these two equations. They are not the real equations of motion, as was said here. They are something like initial conditions. for your system. So let me, so 3 and 4, the statement is that 3 and 4 are something like initial conditions. And so why is that? So basically, okay, so let me take this equation, equation number one, and let me take the divergence of that. Or maybe let me start with divergence of the equation of two. Okay, so then I have divergence of the rotation of E plus, now I can switch the order of the derivatives, d over dt, divergence of B equals to zero, right? But does it ring the bell? So you have divergence of rotation of something, of curl of something. And that's a mathematical identity which always gives zero. So this guy is zero. It's just an identity, like zero equals to zero. So you see that if I take the second equation, that it implies that the derivative of divergence of B equals to zero. So now look at this equation here. So this is like something like I'm saying at time t equal to zero at the Big Bang, I created divergence B so that there are no sources for B. There are no magnetic charges at time equal to zero. And if this is true, then this gives me the evolution of magnetic charges in the future. So this is an initial condition for that equation here. So once I know that there are no magnetic charges at the Big Bang, I know that there are no magnetic charges forever. So the exactly the same situation is with the equation number one. So taking divergence of one, I have minus d over dt, divergence of E, which is the second term. I have divergence of curl of B, which again, zero. So this term doesn't contribute. The terms is what I'm writing down. And this equals to 4 pi divergence of J. But you know that J is the current. This is the electric density. And it satisfies the continuity equation, right? So you know that this guy here is minus dO over dt by the continuity equation. So what you are getting is minus 4 pi dO over dt. And look at that. If I look here, I have d over dt divergence of E, and I have 4 pi d over d rho t, which is precisely this equation. Again, it's time derivative. So again, this equation here is the initial condition for that equation there. So these two things are initial conditions for these two things. So now we are happy because we indeed have six equations for six unknowns, E and B. And we have also initial conditions for them. Okay. So now let's see how to write these equations. So we are physicists, we want to write them nicely. So how to write them so that they are nice? And they are basically, so interpretation of this equation is interpretation. And basically, you can write down these equations in two different ways. One way, which I used here already, is a relativistic point of view. And in relativity, you always write your equations down. There is some differential operator acting, so differential operator acting on your field. And this equals to the source of the field. So this is precisely what I have written down here. So on the left-hand side, you have the fields E and B, and you have various derivatives of them. You have curl, you have d over dt. But on the right-hand side, you have the source. So J, the current, is the source of the E field, and rho, of E and B field, and rho is the source of that equation. So this is the way how you would write these equations in relativity. So similarly, you may already know that the Einstein equations are written like that. So this guy is a differential operator on the metric. So again, differential operator on the field. Field is the metric, how you measure distances in the space-time. And here you put the source. There might be 8 pi and so on. But it's the same thing. Okay? So that's one way how to do that. Another way how mathematicians usually write it is evolution equation. So you may look at these equations like evolution equations. And in that case, you have first derivatives of these things. So you would write the equation dE over dt equals to something, and dB over dt equals to something, and the initial conditions. So that's another way how to write these equations. And that's the way actually mathematicians like it. So only two proper ways how to write these Maxwell equations. Okay. And this is precisely what I didn't learn at the university. So at the university, we would write, you would put all the terms on the left-hand side or all the terms on the right-hand side, or some weird mixture of these. But these two point of view are actually the nice point of view. Okay. So finally, let me mention two other forms, which you may be already familiar with. So number three, so other forms. There are basically two other forms. One of them is that you replace in special relativity or in general relativity, you replace E and B by the electromagnetic tensor F mu nu, which you heard maybe about. And then you write the two equations which have the source, J and rho, in the following form. Nabla mu F mu nu equals to 4 pi J mu. So that's J nu. Thank you. Thank you so much. So which are the equations 1 and 3? And then you write the other equation, F mu nu, let's say kappa, and you do cyclic permutation, and you get 0. And that's the equation number 2 and number 4. So if you haven't seen that, don't worry. You will see it next week or in 2 weeks in general relativity course. So this will be September. So you'll be very clever in September already. So that's complete equivalence to, yes? Sorry? In the bracket. So it's F mu nu, and there is a comma, which is like a derivative. And there is kappa, another index. So you differentiate F mu nu with respect to dx over the kappa. And then you do cyclic permutation, which means I cycle these indices around and sum over that. So don't worry about it. If you haven't seen it, don't worry about it.
It's the Bianchi identity.
It's the Bianchi identity, exactly. And then, yes, there is even simpler way. So now this is simple. I have only these two things. I have four. But now even simpler way is actually in the differential form language. And that one can be written. The first equation is star d star or f equals to 4 pi j. And d of f equals to 0. And that's the most simple way how to write it. It's in the differential form language. If you haven't seen that, don't worry. This you will learn in January. this is a two-form electromagnetic two-form, basically this F mu nu. J is again the source, but now understood as a three-form, and this is the Bianchi identity which somebody mentioned here. So these are two other forms. This is the most simple one. So you see how physics is simple. It's just these two equations, and that's it. Okay. So that's the Maxwell equations. We started with six unknowns in NB, but you can actually, and the equations are of the first order. But now you can actually trade that and write them in terms of the electromagnetic potentials, A and phi, and the equations will be second order. So I trade the number of unknowns. Basically, I reduce them by half, but I've increased the order of the equations. So electromagnetic potentials. Potentials. So the simplest way is to start with the equation number 4. And I know that the divergence of the curl is 0. So I can identically satisfy the equation number 4 by saying that the B is the curl of some other function. Let's call it A. It's called electromagnetic potential. Magnetic potential. Okay, so this guy automatically satisfies the fourth equation. So now let me have a look at the second equation. So you have curl of E plus d over dt of B, but B is curl of A, right? And this must be equal to 0. So let me take curl out, and I have E plus dA over dt equals to 0. And then I can use another mathematical identity, which is that if you have curl of something which is a gradient of any function, so curl of gradient of any function is identically 0. It's the same mathematical identity as 0 equals to 0. So this is automatically satisfied when I choose E to be minus gradient of some function phi, any function phi. So which means that I can satisfy this equation by saying that E is minus gradient of phi minus dA over dt. So what did I do? I basically traded E and B for four functions, A mu. So mu is 0, 1, 2, 3, or 1, 2, 3, 4. Phi and A. And it contains the same information as E and B. Right? But So I had 6, now I have 4, but actually it is not true that I have 4. I have only 3 independent, and that is because there is still, it's called gauge degree of freedom. So now there's gauge degree of freedom. And that comes from the fact that if I take phi and change it to phi plus dt of an arbitrary function lambda, and at the same time I change A, I replace A with A plus the gradient of the same function lambda, So lambda is arbitrary. Then E and B does not change. Okay, so how to see that? You just take this definition of E and B in terms of A and phi and just plug all these things there. So let me just look at B. So you have B is scale of A. So now I change A, instead of A, I write A plus gradient of lambda, but I'm using the same identity that curl of the gradient is zero. So that's why it doesn't change. And you can check that E doesn't change either. That's possible. Yeah, check it, please. Okay. So, but what does it mean that I sort of have one function which is arbitrary? So I had four functions, phi and a, but I can reduce the number of them by one function, lambda. Yes? Has to be plus, yeah. He says. Okay. Can impose. So basically, this function lambda allows me to impose one more condition on these phi and a. And so there are various conditions which you can impose, gauge conditions. And one of them is so-called Lorentz gauge condition. It reads like that. So I basically connect phi with a by choosing this proper lambda there. Or if you are familiar with the special relativity notation, d mu a mu equals to 0. And this is called Lorentz gauge. Condition. Okay, so I traded E and B for three functions, in fact for four, phi and A, but they are connected by this equation, let's say. You can impose other conditions as well, but this is especially nice. So we are heading towards the wave equation. So we already solved the equation number four and the equation number two. So four and two solved by introducing A and B identically, A and phi identically, right? So we just introduce these things and they automatically solve four and two. So what remains to solve is one and three. So let's have a look at three. Okay, so what does it say? So we have divergence of E, but E is now minus grad phi minus dA over dt. So it's divergence of E equals to 4 pi rho. Okay, so now that's very simple. So what is divergence of gradient? We call it in the first lecture Laplacian. Perfect. So we have minus Laplace on phi. And then we have minus d over dt divergence of A equals to 4 pi rho. But I can use that equation, this of the Lorentz gauge condition, right? I can use that. So which means I can write divergence of A as minus dt of phi. So in other words, I'm getting an equation. So this is minus, it's minus, so it's plus d squared over dt of phi. So I have an equation box on phi equals to minus 4 pi rho, where I define this box operator or the Lambert operator to be minus d square over dt square plus the Laplace operator. And it's called the Lambert operator. Okay, but this guy, if you've seen this equation before, nothing else than the wave equation. So we have wave, sometimes called also wave operator. So we have wave operator acting on phi equals to the source. So this is so called wave equation. And you can show it yourself. I will not do that. That if you have problems, we can put it as a problem into the tutorial tomorrow. You can show that the equation 4, using the same trick here, plugging phi and a, gives you the same wave operator now acting on the potential a equals to minus 4 pi j. Again, using the Lorentz condition. So basically what we have done, we have traded the first order Maxwell equations for E and B to the second order wave equations for A and phi, subject to that condition. Okay, now you can again combine these two equations together, and in special relativity notation you would have box on A mu, where A mu is phi and A, equals to minus 4 pi J mu. It's combining that and that. Okay, very good. Questions? No questions? Everybody is happy, that's good. So now we have constructed our wave equation, but we want to have also the solution of this equation. So we want to solve that. And for that, we will use our Green's function method and Fourier transform and everything. So now let's construct the Green's function. Green's function. For that. And so we want to construct a function which satisfies the differential operator acting, the same differential operator as we have there, acting on this Green function. Now for simplicity, so this is function of dx and t. So let's put r and t, the vector. And then we know that we have to put delta source on the right hand side. So it's delta of r and delta of t, and I put big T, so sorry for that, delta of t. So that's my defining equation. And again, I'll be interested in the free space. So I have no boundary conditions, no initial conditions, no nothing. Okay. So now you have learned the Fourier transform. So let's Fourier transform this equation. And let's Fourier transform now. So when we are dealing with the diffusion equation, we Fourier transformed in the x only. But now let's transform in x and t, so in both things. So 1 over 2 pi to the 4. So I'm doing the inverse, so that's why I have this factor here. Now dk and d omega, so omega will replace t, k will replace r. Now g, k, and omega is my Fourier transform thing. And then I have box acting on the exponential. K times R minus I omega times T. So, okay. And this equals to 1 over 2 pi to the 4. Now I'll be using the formula. Okay, so this is precisely the inverse Fourier transform, but now I'm using the scalar product. So I had k dot x, but now I'm using the scalar product where I take the signature minus plus plus plus. So that's why there's one minus here and all the others are plus. It's simply just the Lorentzian scalar product I'm taking here. Okay, so that's I warned you about yesterday. So that's the left hand side, and you see, so this operator x on t and x, so that's why I can push it through this integral. So nothing here depends on x on r and t. So that's why I can push it to the exponential. And then on the right hand side, I will use the formula for the delta function, for the Fourier transform of the delta function I derived yesterday. So this guy is just 1 over 2 pi 4 dk d omega. And you remember there is just the exponential there. Okay. Times r minus I omega times t. Okay, so maybe minus. So there's minus here. So now what is that guy here? So as that's the operator d square over d big letter t square. So if I differentiate twice with respect to t, I get this guy down twice. So it's minus I omega square. And then minus, because it's minus d square over dt square. And then plus the Laplace operator acting on that. So it takes down ik square. Like that, and the exponential is still there. Okay, so I square is minus 1, so that's why this guy is omega square minus k square times the exponential. Okay. So that's great. So what stands here is 1 over 2 pi 4 dk d omega, omega square minus k square, and the exponential, this one here. What stands on the right hand side is minus sign and that thing there. So I can immediately, so I have to satisfy this equation. So I can immediately read what g k omega is, right? So what is that? Uh-huh. Please louder. So it's this guy here. So I solved what my Green's function is, but unfortunately in the k space. So now I have to return back to the x space to have explicit expression for it. So this time, no tricks are allowed, and I really have to do all the work, not like with the diffusion equation. So I'll have to integrate it back. And for that, I gave you this handout, which I called mathematical trivialities or whatever. It's basically what you should know from the complex analysis and from the distribution course. So hopefully Tibra covered all these contour integrals and just like that. So now g r t equals to 1 over 2 pi to the 4. Now I know what is there, so it's 1 over, okay. Let me write it down. It's 1 over k square minus omega square e to I k times r minus I omega t dk dk d omega. Right. So now, so this is a three-dimensional integral in three dimensions. It's d3k remains. And so the simplest way how to calculate that is go to spherical coordinates, in which case I can write this guy dk, or if you want d3k equals to d of cosine theta, d phi, but nothing will depend on phi, so it's 2 pi for the integration over phi angle. And then k square, where this is just the magnitude of the radius in the and dk. So I'm choosing basically, so the picture. So I have k like that, which is the magnitude k, and I have r like that, and let me call this angle theta here. In between them. So just nothing else than just the spherical coordinates in k space. Right? So when I use them, I can rewrite this as 1 over 2 pi to power 4 integral. So now this is the magnitude of k, so it's just k square without the arrow now. So it's 1 over k square minus omega square. Now I have the exponential. So what is the scalar product of k times r when I choose my coordinates that theta is this angle here? It's cosine. Yeah. Perfect. It's I times k times, now without scalar product, k times r times cosine theta, and then minus I omega t. Okay, then I have these 2 pi from there, and then I have d cosine theta k square dk. So that's it, I just plugged that there. So now, what are the boundaries cosine theta goes from? Goes from minus 1 to plus 1, right? So theta goes from minus pi by half, pi half, whatever. But this guy goes from minus 1 to plus 1. So, and the only occurrence in the integral is here. So basically, I will have terms where this guy is plus 1 and that guy is minus 1. Okay? So let me use these 2 pi to cancel one of these 2 pi's here. So it's 1 over 2 pi cube, right? These two terms. And then I have integral d omega. I forgot it here. D omega is still there. And then the integral from 0 to infinity, which is the integral over the radius of k, so it's over k. And then from here, I have e to I kr, when cosine theta is plus 1, minus e to I k minus r, this minus here, over k square minus omega square. And why did I lose my k square? Right. But when I'm actually integrating over that, over cosine theta, I will have this term which stands in front of that going down when I'm integrating the exponential I'll have 1 over I K R. So it's 1 over I K R K square DK. Everybody happy so far? Yes? Sorry?
Where is the time dependence of the explanation?
It is still that. Thank you. E to minus I omega t. Thank you so much. Okay. Which time do we have? Perfect. Always beautiful equation, delete it. Okay, so you see that I can take R outside. This K cancels one of the Ks there. So the big problem is the integral over the K. So let me call an integral I and do it separately. And it's an integral from 0 to infinity, a to k times r minus e to minus I k times r k square minus omega square. Now k dk. So that's the integral I'll have to do. And okay. So first, let me note that if I change k to minus k, it gives me precisely the same thing. So that's why I can basically integrate only one of these terms and go from minus infinity to infinity. So I'll just write it down. So it's an integral. Think about it. But it comes from the fact that if I change k to minus k, it's the same thing. It's an integral from minus infinity to infinity, k a k r over k square minus omega square. Okay. Let me call this function here function f. Okay. So you probably have seen this integral in Tibra's course. Maybe. So we need to use this contour integration to actually calculate it. And the function f has two poles. It has pole in k equal to omega and k equal to minus omega. So this is my k plane. 0. I have one pole at omega, another pole at minus omega. So in fact, the integral doesn't make sense unless I tell you. So you integrate from minus infinity to infinity, but you have two poles on the way. So I have to tell you that you have to avoid this integral. So actually, this integral is defined only as a principal value of the integral. So I decide to go around these poles like that. So my contour will be, I go like this, I go like that, and I go like that. Let me call. So now, if you're actually going around the pole, you pick up some residue or whatever. So let me call the integration over this pole I1, the integration over that pole I2, and the whole integral which I want, which is this thing here, an integral I. Okay. So now, you know that if you are calculating this this contour integral, that you pick up the poles which are inside that contour which you have chosen. So how many poles are there? There are 0 poles. So that's why the integral I. So now what also matters is the direction of the integration. So here I go that direction. So I take that integral plus, but here I go opposite direction. I take these integrals minus. So it's I minus I1 minus I2 equals to the poles inside, but there are no poles, so that's equal to zero. So we know that the integral which we want equals to I1 plus I2. Okay, so this integral equals to I1 plus I2. And then for that, I give you these endouts, and you can apply this Jordan lemma. So it gives you how to how to go around the pole. And basically the prescription is that you pick up the difference of the angles, how far you are going. So this you start at the zero angle, and here you finish at the pi angle. So that's why you have pi I. So this equals to I times pi times the residue in this pole and in that pole. So residue at minus omega of this function fk plus the residue of omega is this fk. Okay, so now the question is, how do I calculate this residuum of the function f? And because I have simple pole there, then again, you pick up your handout, look at one of the lemmas there. And it gives you that if there is a simple pole, I need to evaluate what stands above, what doesn't have pole. I evaluate simply in the pole, so in omega, and then I differentiate the bottom and plug what is omega there. So in principle, so I have minus omega from e to minus I k omega, which is in front, and then I have to differentiate the bottom, which gives me 2k, and I plug it for minus omega, which gives me minus 2 omega, right? And the other one would be the same thing, so it's omega I k omega over 2 omega. Yes? Yes. I'm integrating over k.
So it should be I omega r.
Yeah, sure. What I'm doing here. Yeah, thank you so much. So it should be omega instead of k, but r. Yeah, thank you. Now you're happy? Very good. Very good. Okay. Very good. Do you have your handouts there? So if you look at your handouts, number 2, and I don't have it here. Anybody has it here? Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. So when I do this integration, I am using first the theorem, the equation number 2. So there are no poles inside, so that's why I have 0 here. Then I close it like that, and I need to show that the integral over that thing is equal to 0. So for that, I am using the lemma, which is on page number 2, and it's the equation 7. So I take r to be positive, which is our gamma, which we have in that equation. And then asymptotically, if you go with k to infinity, then this behaves like 1 over k and the exponential. So if I take k times fk, doesn't go to zero, right? k times fk. No. The fk goes to zero because it behaves like 1 over k for k large times the exponential. So it's really the lemma part b, which gives you that that integral there doesn't contribute. And then for calculating these residua here, I use this property number 2 in the lemma on the first page, is the equation number 3. Equation number 3 gives you these two things. Thank you so much. Okay, so this is I pi over 2. Now omega cancel. It's minus I omega plus I r omega. So that's my integral. And I lost my notes. Maybe I'll write it here. Okay, so now I know what this integral is. So I can return back to my integration of the whole thing, which I started there. Okay, so my g is all the formulas I need. So my g is 1 over 2 pi. To power 3, then I have 1 over IR from there, then I have integral from minus infinity to infinity d omega, then I know what the integral over k is, which is I pi over 2 e to minus IR omega plus e to plus R omega d omega. Okay, so now this I cancels that I. This is 8. It gives me another 2. So it's 1 over 16, 1 over, okay. Let me write it like that. 8 pi times 2 pi. That's certainly true. Okay, 2 pi, 1 over r. And then, and I'm still missing, again, my factor e to minus I omega t, which is still there. Right? So I have 1 over r integral over d omega. And then let me collect the exponentials. So one exponential will be e to minus I omega r plus t. And the other exponential will be plus minus I omega t minus r, or something like that. Minus I omega t plus, yeah. So this should work. So very good. So now I use the definition of the delta function again. And you remember that if you have 1 over 2 pi d omega of I and whatever stands here, that's the delta function. So this equals to 1 over 8 pi. So I need these 2 pi for my delta function. 1 over r is still there. And then I have delta of r plus t from this integral and delta of t minus r from the other integral. Yeah. It's the formula I derived last time. So delta of x equals to 1 over pi integral over dk e to minus I xk, something like that. Right? Or using the formula which you have again in this mathematical perennial is the last formula on the distributions. You can combine these two functions, these two delta functions together. And you get 1 over, and you pick up 1 half, I guess. You get, pick up the factor 2. 1 over 4 pi and delta r square minus t square over r. Okay, so that's the result. That's your Green's function for the wave operator. So now the discussion. So first of all, from this, it is obvious that you have r square minus t square. It means that the disturbance propagates at the speed of light. So only when r square equals to t square, there is missing c. So c is 1, so there will be c t square. But only when r square equals to t square, there is non-trivial contribution. So only on the light cone, the electromagnetic waves propagate on the light cone with the speed of light. Okay, so that's from that formula, yes? How it came from here to there is the last formula in your handouts, where you have delta of function of x equals to the sum over I, and then you, how was it, f. So if you have solution called, so fx equal to 0, fx equal to 0, it has some solutions. Let's say x equal to a1, a2, a3, and so on. So then this thing can be written as f evaluated at I. Oh, again, can I borrow your handout? So it's the formula 9. So it can be written as delta x minus the root of that fx equal to 0 over the derivative of f at these things. So if you look at here, I have the function f is r square minus t square. So it has solution r equals to plus t and r equals to minus t. And the derivative is 2. So that's why I'm getting these two here, 8 pi and here 4 pi. So and it's delta r plus t delta r minus t. Yeah, very good question. Thank you so much. Okay. So now this guy is called advanced potential. And the other one is called retarded potential. So why is it so? So t minus r has to be equal to 0. So only for time, when time reaches r, this is non-trivial. But so in later times, this is non-trivial. That's why it's called retarded part. And this is for minus r. So it's like advanced. It happens for negative time, basically. So that's kind of why it is called advance. Okay, so now what do you do in classical electrodynamics? Do you use both these potentials or one of them, none of them? The retarded one. So exactly, that's an assumption actually. So it doesn't come from the equations. So you start with the equations, Maxwell equations. You do that and you get both these potentials. Now physics assumption is that you forget about one of them. So in classical electrodynamics, you say this doesn't exist. It doesn't occur in nature. Sorry? I'll talk about it, yes. But that's not what you do in classical electrodynamics. You just simply say, I don't want advanced potentials. Let's concentrate on the retarded ones because our experience tells us that something has to happen first and then it can influence the other thing later, but not before it happens here. So in classical electrodynamics, we take only retarded okay, so basically what we are doing is that we are throwing away one half of the physics. So let me do that. So we know what the green function is. So now because I throw away this one here, I have to take this one twice so that it works actually. So if I want, what is my potential phi at the position r and at time t? This is given by the formula which we know from the first and second lecture. It's the Green function r, r prime, t, t prime. Now times the source. Source is 4 pi j, 4 pi rho, r time, r prime, t prime, dr prime, dt prime. That's just the formula for how to extract the solution from the Green's function. So now my Green's function is t minus t prime minus r prime. So I'll just write. So this equals to the integral delta. Now this big r is as in the first lecture is r minus r prime, and this big t is t minus t prime, as we had in the first lecture. So what is here is this delta function there. So it's delta t minus r. So it's t minus t prime minus r prime. And then you have, so 4 pi cancel. So if I take that one guy twice, because I have only now retarded thing, it will be 4 pi. So 4 pi cancels 4 pi. And I just get 1 over r. And 1 over r is r minus r prime. Rho r prime, t prime, dr prime, dt prime. So that's my beautiful solution. So people usually integrate over t prime, which is very simple to do because I have it in my delta function. So basically what it tells you that you have to replace t prime with t minus this guy here, everywhere it occurs, which means here. So this guy is equal to integral over the r prime. And now rho r prime and t prime, I replace this that. So it's t minus r prime over r minus r prime. And that's my phi of r and t. So that's the most general solution of your wave equation. So using the property of the delta function. Yeah? It can give 0 for 0 charge. Okay, it's okay. It's not the most general. It's the, again, if you have inhomogeneous equation, the most general solution is the most general solution of the homogeneous equation plus the one with the source. Okay, so this is the one with the source. I still need to add the general solution for box on phi equals to zero. Yeah, so sorry. It's not the most general solution. Thank you. Okay. So now, this is all good, but we have thrown away half of the physics. And here comes the Feynman. So yesterday you learned from Bill Andrew that you should understand particles as something which is detected by the particles detector. And you learned from him that people in the 30s could have discovered Andrew's radiation already. So now I'll tell you what they actually were concerned in the 30s. So they were actually concerned about the theory of the electron. They were interested what the electron can be. And so now history lesson, and let me call it Feynman story. But okay. So Feynman. So what people were mostly concerned from the beginning of the 20th century till 1960s is basically the theory of the electron. So problem of electron. So what electron is? How can that be? And so the most naive thing which occurred at the beginning of the 20th century was that the electron is just some ball or something which possesses this electric charge. It produces the electric field. So this ball, this is actually the model proposed by Lorentz, had radius r. And so it's composed of some matter, and it produces the electric field. So it produces the electric field everywhere. You know that, okay. But what it means is that here actually, so if you have the same charge, it repels each other. So there should be actually a force trying to explode the electron. So in order this not to happen, people thought, well, there must be some negative pressure. They call it, well, negative pressure. Pressure. Which would held, which would hold the electron together. So there's this repulsive force of the same charge, but I can save that situation. But there's actually a problem with this model once you start to move the electron. So if it's static, if it stands here, remains here, then you can do that. But once you start to move it, when it starts accelerating and so on, there is a problem of self-force. Of the electron on itself. Basically, what it means is that the electromagnetic field of the electron reacts with the matter which is inside the electron. So it tries to push it away, but once you move it, it's not spherically symmetric. It starts to deform the field and so on. And Lorentz calculated that the self energy, self force, which it acts on itself, is given by some kind of energy of the electron times the acceleration of the electron. And there is another term, which is proportional to the e square of the electron and the derivative of the acceleration. Okay, so now we don't have Newtonian physics because the forces now depends on A, whereas in Newtonian and A dot, whereas in Newtonian physics it can depend only on the velocities. Well, even strictly speaking, on positions only. But this is not the whole story. There's other terms as well, and there's actually infinite of them. And you get infinite derivatives there. So you have something, some constant, and then you have dn a over dtn. And this depends on the radius of the electron. So basically, if you want to solve the Newton's equation, F equals to ma, and you use this F, then you have infinite number of derivatives of A, which means you need infinite number of initial conditions, and so on. So it's a big problem. This term, all these terms are a big problem. So how to deal with that? So people could think about two ways how to deal with that. So first, so way out. One of them is that, okay, so two situations can happen. Okay, that's not two possibilities. So R is finite, but you see, because of all these terms, that's a complete disaster. You cannot solve that equation. No way you could solve it. You need negative pressure to balance even in the static case and so on. So the other possibility was that R goes to zero. So you have point particle. But then what happens is actually, well, all these terms are gone. this term remains, but okay, I need some more initial conditions for that, but these are gone. But this guy here is the self-energy of the electron. So now what is the self-energy of the electron? If you look at this picture, so how to calculate the electrostatic energy of something which has radius equals zero, or radius r, let's say first. So you know that the electrostatic, the density of the electrostatic energy is E square, where E is the electric intensity. So E for the Coulomb law goes like R square, 1 over R square. So V self is E square dV. Everywhere you have the electric intensity. So E goes like 1 over R square. dV goes like R square dr. So this thing goes like 1 over R square to square R square dr. This is the electric intensity. This is just the volume element. So this is 1 over R 4, 1 over R square. So the whole thing, if you integrate it, goes like 1 over R. Right? But now what I'm doing, so this is the electrostatic energy of the electron. But now I'm setting R equal to 0. What does it mean? That this guy is in fact infinite. It's an infinite electron, has infinite electrostatic energy. Right? So if this happens, this V self goes to infinity. So you have infinite force on the right hand side now. So there is no way out. Either you have finite size of the electron, and you have infinite, well, you have horrible equation, or you have point electron, and but you have this guy on the right hand side, you have infinite mass, yes? The charge, well, they had the simplest possible model where the charge is actually distributed uniformly in this way, yes. Uniformly in this way, yes.
But if uniformly, the E is
perfect. No, well, E is everywhere, right? E is everywhere outside radius. Yeah, everywhere outside. So now I just send this radius to zero, so field is everywhere. And it becomes obvious because the electric force is really divergent at r equal to zero. So that's why the contribution to the energy is infinite.
But inside a sphere with uniform charge distribution, the E is proportional to r.
Well, inside the sphere it's fine. Inside the sphere is fine. But if I say send r equals to zero, I have problem. If I don't send, I have this problem here. And basically, so this guy, so now we know that this is not a problem. And that's basically the beginning of renormalization. But of course, this was not understood until 1960s. So that's why people couldn't make sense of that. And so what happens actually in the renormalization case is that you see that this guy is infinite, but it's the time is proportional to the acceleration. But on the other hand, you know that F equals to ma, right? The mass of the electron times its acceleration. So now this is acceleration. That is acceleration. So why not to combine m of the electron with this self-energy? Of course, then I have to send the mass of the electron to minus infinity. So then I take m minus v self. And I want this to be the true proper mass of the electron, which I measure. So this is minus infinite, so I have to send this guy plus infinite, but who cares? I just measure that. So that's the beginning of the renormalization theory.
Didn't Dirac solve this in 1938 with his renormalization procedure?
Sorry, once more?
Didn't Dirac solve the relativistic?
Exactly, yeah, perfect.
Version of this in 1938?
Very good. Yeah, so the way out, so you can do this renormalization, and you can go get so-called Lorentz Dirac equation, which now I don't have time to discuss because I'm already running out of time. But you can make sense of that. Basically, you preserve the first two terms, but now you take this physical mass there. So you don't have this problem of self-energy. But really, it's because the renormalization. So that's what people were doing in 1930s, 1940s, 1950s. That's why they didn't discover Amu effect. OK. So now let me come back to Feynman. And I gave you these handouts. So Feynman, in 1931 or whatever, he was a graduate student in Princeton. And he was interested in these things. And he was aware of these two problems. He didn't know the renormalization solution for that. And he said, well, what happens if I actually do not allow the electron to act on itself? What happens if only electron can act on the other electron? And so you can read about this story in the book, which I recommend it. So it's this book, Surely You Must Be Joking, Mr. Feynman. And the chapter is actually called Monster Minds. Right? So he came to this idea that you can have only electron-electron interaction. And I gave you these handouts where you can read this very chapter, but this is actually a very entertaining book, so if you just want to. So, but if you have only electrons acting one on the other and not on itself, there is a problem with radiation force. There is the problem with the second term. You cannot get that term if the electron doesn't act on itself, but acts only on the electron. So what happens if you start accelerating the electron, it starts radiating the field, and the field pushes back so that the electron actually starts to decelerate itself. So this is called radiation force. And so he couldn't solve that. And so he came, okay. So he came to Wheeler and he said, well, I have this electron-electron interaction. I don't have the problem of this infinite self force in that case, but I cannot explain the radiation force. And then he said, well, what if I actually, one of the electrons here sent a signal to the other electron, that one shakes, sends a signal back, and that's the thing, when the radiation returning back hits the first electron, that's the radiation force. And Wheeler immediately told him, well, this would depend on all these quantities here, Q2, M2, on the distance between these two particles and so on. It would occur in the wrong time because it would need time to actually for the signal to travel there, travel back, so it wouldn't occur immediately. So that's why he said, well, this is not possible, but what you have just described is ordinary reflection of the light. So you send light there, it returns back. But then he said, okay, but what if I don't use just the retarded potential, but I use the advanced potential as well? It's allowed by equations, why not? So let's use both these potentials. And then what would happen actually if you have finite number of charges in the universe, this wouldn't work because you would really violate the causality. But if there is an infinite number of charges in the universe, basically there is something like an absorber at the boundary of the universe which can absorb all the radiation at infinite time, then actually if you use these two potentials and you use this k equal to 1/2, so you use basically 1/2 of the retarded potentials and 1/2 of the advanced potentials, then you exactly get cancellation. You don't violate causality, the effect, and the Lorentz force law is precisely what you want it to be. So this is MA on the left-hand side. This is just the standard Lorentz law, and this gamma mu is precisely the second term here, the radiation force. So if you actually use both half retarded and half advanced potential, you get radiation force, and everything is fine. So the only condition is that you have to have infinite number of charges in the universe, which actually absorb the radiation at the end of the universe. Okay, so that was beautiful theory. It is actually macroscopically reversible. It is able to describe the damping force. And what is even more beautiful is actually that you can describe everything in terms of this action. And if you look at that action, something really remarkable. That what do you see here? So m is the mass of the particle, this is the action, and you see, so this is the position of the particle, x dot, and the charges of the particles, and again, the positions of the particles and their velocities. Do you see any field, a mu, here? There is no field a mu. So this action is completely written without any field. This is a direct interparticle interaction. It's the old Newtonian theory where you have interaction between two particles without any field. So this is the only example of actually relativistic field theory, without relativistic theory without any fields. And it's something really, really remarkable. So it's pure particle-particle interaction, no field. And actually, people tried. So this is classically absolutely correct. There's no word against it. The only problem is that they did not find how to quantize that. So that's why is the only problem of this theory. People tried to formulate gravity in this form. So far, they failed. So far, you really need gravitational field. You need metric to describe gravity. But maybe there's still some possibility to do that. So this beautiful theory of electromagnetism, classically absolutely perfect. But quantum mechanically, people tried to quantize it, but failed. And let me see what Feynman said. So read the chapter how Feynman was giving the first seminar, and how Einstein came to his seminar, and Wigner came, and Pauli, and Feynman was very scared. And so anyway, but in the end, actually, Pauli told him that something is wrong and about the quantum theory, and asked what Wheeler is doing. And Wheeler was not giving the seminar. And he said, OK, Wheeler is working on the quantum theory. He will give next seminar about the quantum theory. And Pauli told him, he came closer to me and said in a low secretive voice, Wheeler will never give that seminar. He will never discover quantum theory of this theory. And actually, he never did. And Feynman spent lots of years trying to quantize that theory, and he also failed. So OK, so that's, please read the chapter. It's really very entertaining. And that's it. Questions?